World poised for a changing of the guard, with Donald Trump on the cusp of becoming America's 47th president. Mr. Trump has arrived at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., where he entered with his successor and predecessor, Joe Biden, for his inauguration. A slew of executive orders on standby, from targeting illegal immigration to pardoning January 6th convicts to ending birthright citizenship, Donald Trump has promised to put pen to paper. Notable attendees at the Trump inauguration, tech CEOs including Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and TikTok's Shou Zhichu. Four other living U.S. presidents, plus Italy's prime minister, Argentina's president, China's vice president, in a major first. Donald Trump has been here before. This time, he survived two assassination attempts, won an election in a historic comeback, and is set to become the second president to serve non-consecutive terms since the late 1800s. Be it because of the economy, immigration, or other reasons, American voters have again handed Donald Trump the keys to the Oval Office. The decision has wide-ranging implications for the world, and we'll be breaking it all down over the next 2 hours. I am Jill Neubrunner. Hello, everyone. With me for this program from Washington, D.C., is our correspondent, Simon Marks. Simon, it is a day of pageantry, despite the inauguration being moved indoors to the rotunda because of that freezing cold weather. We've seen the queues snaking around Capital One Arena, but above all, security is tight.
Yes, absolutely, Jill. Good morning from Washington, D.C., where we are now 58 minutes away from the transition in power at the White House. Donald Trump will be taking the oath of office atop this hour by midday Washington, D.C. time, and seamlessly becoming America's next president. An extraordinary moment that perhaps even Donald Trump and members of his family and his inner circle all gathering there in the Capitol Rotunda for this inauguration, which, as you know, has been moved indoors because it is perishingly cold here today in Washington, the first indoor inauguration since 1985. Donald Trump would have, I think, even 3 years ago, have considered these events to be utterly unimaginable. An extraordinary political return, recovery by a man who is about to become the first felon, the first convicted criminal ever to be sworn into the nation's highest office. He has traveled to Capitol Hill in a limousine alongside Joe Biden. The two men welcomed, Donald Trump was welcomed to the White House by the Bidens, along with First Lady Melania Trump a short while ago. They enjoyed a cup of tea together before making their way up to Capitol Hill for this inauguration ceremony. And what we're going to see play out is everything that we would have seen up outside the Capitol, except inside the rotunda, which can accommodate far fewer observers of this swearing-in ceremony. There'll be a certain amount of pageantry that takes place. The first big moment we're waiting for, the swearing-in of J.D. Vance as the country's next vice president. He and his wife also welcomed to the White House today by Kamala Harris, the outgoing vice president of the United States. And then it will be Donald Trump's term to swear the oath of office and make his inaugural address. And we already know some of the things that Donald Trump is going to say in that inaugural address. He's going to say that he's returning to the presidency confident and optimistic that we are at the start of a thrilling new era of national success. A tide of change, he will say, is sweeping the country. He will announce plans today, and in fact it will be within minutes of him completing that inaugural address, to start signing a series of what he's calling historic executive orders. With these actions, he will say, we will begin the complete restoration of America and what he's calling the revolution of common sense. My message to Americans today, he plans to say, is that it is time for us once again to act with courage, vigor, and the vitality of history's greatest civilization. The mood on Capitol Hill, obviously different than what everybody was anticipating, given the decision to move this indoors. There are only a certain number of people that can possibly watch this inauguration in person, only a few hundred, but they do include former presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Former first ladies, Hillary Clinton and Laura Bush. Michelle Obama has decided to stay away from this swearing-in ceremony, as has the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, choosing not to be there to see Donald Trump's return to power. So we've got an exciting couple of hours ahead. And I can tell you, Jill, that you really can sense change in the air here in Washington, D.C. today. I mean, even on my way down here on the city's underground system this morning, suddenly the underground trains were all packed with supporters of Donald Trump and his Make America Great Again movement. This, as you know, is a Democratic Party stronghold, and it was a very early morning symbol of the change that by tonight will be redolent across this city.
Simon, they say if you want to get anywhere in Washington, D.C., you'll have to walk. And right now, looking at the live pictures, we are seeing members of the Supreme Court justices walking in now, about to take their place in the rotunda. We know that Donald Trump will take the oath of office, likely administered by U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. Now, I am not alone in the studio. Joining us for the first hour tonight is Dr. Adrian Ng. He is Research Fellow and Coordinator of the United States Program, Institute of Defense and Strategic Studies, RSIS. Adrian, we're, what, an hour away from the big moment, Donald Trump's inauguration as the 47th president. As we sit here watching from Asia, what will you be looking out for today?
Hi, Jill. Thanks for having me on. In Asia, we'll be looking, right, listening to Trump's inaugural address and trying to see what sort of vision he lays out for the United States, right, and his administration for the next 4 years, particularly in foreign policy. So it will really be interesting for us to compare right, his first inaugural address to this inaugural address today. Basically, right, sort of looking at America's place in the world and, you know, hopefully giving us a glimpse of what he intends to do. So he has, of course, you know, promised tariffs for the rest of the world. Right, we will see, you know, whether tariffs make it into the inaugural address and what he makes of America's place in the world. Is it going to continue on an outward internationalist path, or is he going to go with America First, a more nationalist America?
All right, we'll listen out for all those things. And as we wait for the big moment, we see that many members of the Congress and cabinet nominees have made it into the rotunda, a large dome, circular room located right in the sector of U.S. Capitol. Now, Donald Trump's return to the White House is a milestone in a period of U.S. history littered with political and legal firsts. As we await the oath of office, let's take a look at what led to this moment.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
The classic adage goes, one should never say never again. Donald Trump's refusal to concede the outcome of the 2020 vote culminated in an attempted insurrection that many politicians, including those in his own party, thought signaled the end of the Trump era. But 4 years on, Donald Trump is back. Having swept both the Electoral College and the popular vote, he resumes his vision for America from where he left off in 2021. Top of his agenda, immigration.
On day one, we will begin the largest deportation effort in the history of our country.
The incoming president says he intends to declare a national emergency, which could unlock at least some of the estimated $86 billion needed to carry out the crackdown. Cheaper, his team says, than aiding migrants. Trump also plans to mobilize the U.S. military to help remove upwards of 11 million people in the country illegally. But the The military's role in civil law enforcement is supposed to be limited.
Typically speaking, it's insurrection, terrorism, you know, things of national, immediate, and limited in duration. They cannot, though, make determinations about whether or not someone is here legally or not legally.
But legality is something Donald Trump has often pushed the boundaries of. This became a familiar sight in 2024. Trump facing dozens of charges in multiple indictments, all of which he denies. He didn't win in the courtroom, but at the ballot box, and that has consigned his outstanding trials to the ash heap of history. On the matter of his election loss in 2020, a Department of Justice report found he would have been convicted of illegally trying to overturn the result if not for his recent re-election victory in 2024. But after the verdict in the hush money trial in New York, Donald Trump becomes the first convicted felon to enter the White House. Decisions he now makes will have global implications, none more so than his threat to raise tariffs. He suggested a 10% universal import tariff, threatened 25% duties on goods from neighbours Mexico and Canada, and up to 60% on Chinese imports. When Trump was last in charge, the US introduced tariffs on $360 billion worth of goods from China, forcing Beijing to fight back with reciprocal tariffs on US goods. One stated aim of Trump's new tariff plan is to increase US manufacturing and reduce reliance on others like China. But it may also push U.S. trade partners away.
For all of these countries, the relationship between the U.S. and China is going to be an increasingly difficult one for them to balance. And Trump might make it easier for them to choose China, even while he's putting his finger on the scale to try and do exactly the opposite.
Elsewhere, one of America's top allies, the European Union, is bracing for a frosty 4 years. Just days before taking office, Donald Trump issued a warning to Denmark. Either the EU member state gives up the mineral resource-rich autonomous territory of Greenland or faces tariffs. The president-elect says it's a matter of national security, citing the influence of Russia and China in the region. The European Commission has rejected the idea outright. Many European governments are also likely to struggle to meet Donald Trump's demand that NATO allies pay 5% on defence, up from the current target of 2% of GDP. To appease Washington, the EU is instead floating the idea of importing more liquefied natural gas from the US. International and domestic audiences are preparing for what Trump 2.0 will bring, but it will be up to Donald Trump to determine whether their expectations line up with his America First philosophy.
Members of Congress, cabinet nominees, past presidents, VIPs, foreign dignitaries, CEOs of the tech world, all filling up the seats in the rotunda very slowly as we work our way up to the moment. Now, countries around the world also preparing for a Trump 2.0 foreign policy. We hear from our correspondents next in Beijing, Moscow and Tel Aviv when CNA's US presidential inauguration special coverage returns.
Outside of love and religion, it's the most beautiful word there is. Tariff! My message is simple. Make your product here in America and only in America. So we're going to charge tariffs. Nothing will stop me from keeping my word to you, the people. We will make America safe, strong, prosperous, powerful, and free again.
Welcome to Lock and Store, where we make storage simple, secure, and sustainable.
Choose from well-lit and air-conditioned storage spaces ranging from lockers to 200 square foot units. Visit or contact Lock & Store today.
There's something magical about Karakoma Hall itself. There's something about the place where every phase of its story is different and interesting.
Karikal Mahal was named after his hometown, Karikal. Mahal is in palace.
It was built for entertaining the good and the great of Singapore.
Karikal Mahal was such a palatial, resplendent environment.
When the Japanese invaded Singapore, they took the Karakoma Mahal and repurposed it as a temporary holding site for prisoners of war.
This is the magic of Karakoma Mahal itself. It has a tendency to attract the strange.
People know that if you go into class, it means you didn't do as well.
Then they call us Sansui and everything.
Liang En.
Jinsu already fail already. Because I'm stupid.
You may not pass this time round, but you always learn.
When they are present in the classroom, it's really half of the battle won.
It's my dream to open a cafe.
Do air stewarding.
Become a mechanic choreographer.
When I go on stage, I just felt that freedom.
Yelling for yours, it tastes perfect.
CRES is a school for the underdog.
Come here and be happy. CRES is the best school in the world.
Welcome back to our continuing special coverage of the US presidential inauguration right here on CNA. We're looking at live pictures in the rotunda preparing for the moment the 47th president of the United States is sworn in. We're seeing the Supreme Court justices take their seats, and moments ago, the shoulders of the men that President Trump will be standing on, former presidents of America, their presence showing the world and the Americans their respect and support for the peaceful transfer of power. Well, Donald Trump will have his hands full with many foreign policy issues, but relations with China, Russia and Israel will likely take priority. Well, let's go now to our correspondents standing by. We've got Tan Sohui, who's in Beijing, Dasha Chernyshova in Moscow and Sarah Coates in Tel Aviv. But first, Sohui, to you. Now, we have, Sohui, been asking over the weekend for viewers to send their questions in on the elections. And we have one for you now. They're asking, how will Mr. Trump handle the U.S.-China relationship in his second presidency? Where might he enhance collaboration? And, of course, on the flip side, which areas might see increased tensions? Sohui.
Now, that's a really good question, but there's actually loads of uncertainties when it comes to Trump's moves towards China. But in my conversations with experts and observers, they have raised some concerns in a couple of areas where they could possibly see increased tensions with China. Now, firstly, of course, it would be the economy, as Trump had previously pledged to increase tariffs. In fact, as high as 60% on all Chinese goods. And so this could impact the Chinese economy, which is already currently stuttering. But at the same time, observers are saying that Mr. Trump is an unpredictable leader, and so he could possibly change his mind, as he prefers a more personal diplomacy to make decisions on a certain on certain decisions. And so the second part would be cybersecurity. They're saying that Mr. Joe Biden, the predecessor, he had signed executive orders to increase cybersecurity rules to shore up defense against foreign adversaries. And he had cited and linked this to so-called Chinese espionage. And so this could be seen as a continuation of aggressive stance when it comes to cybersecurity. But at the same time, Mr. Trump had previously said that he wants to have a more hands-off approach when it comes to regulation. In fact, a more aggressive stance when it comes to a reduction of regulation. And so a lot remains to be seen, a lot of uncertainties, including the issue of Taiwan, which is a very sensitive topic to China as China sees Taiwan as a renegade province. But even so, both sides, China and the U.S., in the lead-up to Trump's inauguration, it has been cordial. Mr. Xi Jinping, China's president, he had a phone call with Mr. Trump on Friday, and they had talked about trade, they had talked about TikTok, they had talked about fentanyl, but above all, they had called for a fresh start to U.S.-China relations. This comes after the announcement that Chinese Vice President Han Zheng will be attending Trump's inauguration. Now, he is the highest and most senior official in China's history to have attended a U.S. president's inauguration. And that's after Chinese President Xi Jinping had declined Mr. Trump's invitation to attend the event. But it is rare that heads of states would attend such inaugurations, as it's seen as an American event. And also, China's Foreign Affairs Ministry, they had made a comment as well on Trump's inauguration on Monday. And they had said that they hope to see more healthy and stable relations with the U.S.
And it's significant that the teams are already talking, even at this stage. Now, we want to thank you, Sir Hui, and go over to Moscow, where Dasha Chernyshova is standing by. And Dasha, a viewer question to you as well. And the question is, will Mr. Trump be able to end the Russian-Ukraine war? On what terms? What are Putin's red lines? And is he even ready to negotiate?
Well, certainly a very good question. And what we understand from the Russian officials and the Russian president, who has just congratulated Donald Trump on taking the Oval Office, is that Moscow is indeed open for dialogue with the United States. And in fact, Moscow welcomes the very idea that there has been the change in the stance in Washington, with the new administration saying they want to engage into dialogue, to resume the dialogue that Moscow says has been stopped because of the outgoing Joe Biden administration in the United States. So the Russian president has said that there has to be the conversation between the two capitals, but based on the equal footing, where the two come with equal positions. And Moscow has stressed that there are many issues of interest for Moscow and Washington to discuss. We also are hearing from President Vladimir Putin that even though Moscow is open for the negotiations, including on Ukraine, there has to be the understanding in the West of the root causes of the Ukraine conflict. And here we come to the second very important issue. Moscow is ready to settle on Ukraine, but only if its concerns are alleviated. And those concerns are primarily NATO expansion eastwards. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has recently been speaking that there has been a change in tone in the United States when it comes to Donald Trump himself and Mike Waltz, who is supposed to become Donald Trump's national security advisor. They have been both speaking about the root cause of the Ukraine conflict and NATO role in this. So the hope in Moscow is indeed that this root cause will be addressed. And this is something that is of paramount importance for any prospect of peace settlement for Ukraine. We also understand that Moscow is quite concerned with the current situation when it comes to the global security escalation. And Moscow has been stressing that it does want a wider security deal clinched, but that will also need to see Moscow meeting its demands when it comes to Russia's security on the continent. So again, Moscow continues to say it is open for the negotiations. It welcomes the very desire of the U.S. New administration to engage into the dialogue, but at the same time, Moscow is quite strongly saying that its goals will have to be met both in Ukraine and internationally. So it is very cautiously looking at how the new American administration will be approaching those issues, not just making the claims, but actually taking the real steps. And also, we understand that in Moscow, there is no illusion that there will be any change, major change, when it comes to the sanctions policy. Russia has been sanctioned heavily by the United States and other Western countries, so the understanding in Moscow is that those sanctions will actually remain in place.
Dasha, thank you. As we go to our live pictures once more of the rotunda, just a short while ago, seeing the First Lady and the First Gentleman take their place. Now, let's shift over to the Middle East, where tensions between Israel and Hamas will likely be top of mind for Mr. Trump's incoming administration. Let's get more details now from Sarah Coates. She joins us live from Tel Aviv. Sarah, given that Mr. Trump has an America First agenda, how might you expect U.S. involvement in Gaza to evolve under his leadership?
Hello there, Jill. Mr. Trump really likes to see himself as a peacemaker, and he's taken a lot of credit for this ceasefire in Gaza, which of course went into effect yesterday. Just during one of his rallies yesterday, he came out to say that this is the first step toward lasting peace in the region. But in saying that, there certainly are a lot of challenges for Mr. Trump ahead. Now, one of the most sort of pressing, I think you could say, would be the situation to do with getting aid into the Gaza Strip. Of course, it's just over a week's time that this Israeli ban on the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, will come into effect. And we do understand that one of the first executive orders that Mr. Trump will sign is stopping funding to UNRWA as part of that America First policy. So right now it remains unclear as to what mechanism would be in place for the distribution of all of this vital aid in the Strip to the people who so desperately need it. Now, then, of course, there is the challenge of rebuilding Gaza if and when this initial ceasefire does actually hold, and of course, who would be ruling the Gaza Strip. So these are, I think, the more immediate challenges there for Mr. Trump that will need to be addressed. We've heard from many of his team in this incoming administration that they expect to have a pretty hands-on approach inside Gaza and also here in Israel on the ground. But then we do need to remember that Mr. Trump is really striving for more peace in the Middle East. He's made no secret of the fact that he wants to see this normalization go through between Israel and Saudi Arabia, really an expansion of the Abraham Accords. And this would, of course, bring Israel closer into the Middle East fold and also further isolate Iran and its proxies and then pave the way, Jill, for a two-state solution.
All right, Wilna, thank you, Sarah, and Sir Hui in Beijing, as well as Dasha in Moscow. Thank you, ladies. Now, coming back to our studio guest, Adrian, we've got a couple of questions from our viewers as well for you. One is asking, what will Mr. Trump's foreign policy be like? Very general question. But they also want to know, why is Mr. Trump causing trouble with U.S. allies? And I'm sure you can think of a few names there.
So, broadly speaking, Trump's foreign policy is geared as America first, right? So it is different from the traditional liberal internationalist approach that has sought to build American alliances around the world, that American power is best projected along with allies, right? To maintain America's hegemony, so to speak. Trump believes that, you know, these alliances, these partnerships are actually at America's expense and that America should now demand both more of its allies and partners and assert more of what he thinks are America's interests.
Simon, over to you.
Jill, one point worth making is that this transition is underway so rapidly that by tonight we think America will have a new Secretary of State. We think that action is going to be taken by the Senate very quickly to confirm Marco Rubio as Antony Blinken's successor in that position. And a question for Adrian. I mean, there's obviously this fragile ceasefire now in place in the Middle East. How do you see the Trump team handling that going forwards?
That's a great question, Simon. And I think The Trump administration will want this ceasefire to hold. It is, I think, part of Trump's legacy to move forward with the Abraham Accords. And this will also allow the Trump administration to then focus on Iran as the next part of his Middle East foreign policy, to basically isolate Iran and get Iran to give up its nuclear ambitions.
Well, that's right, isn't it, Adrian? Because I think we were speaking and you were saying that an even bigger piece of the Middle East instability is indeed Iran. Do you think that Trump might be able to use the deal in the Middle East as some sort of impetus for an even wider Arab-Israeli coalition against Tehran?
So that was the basis for his Abraham Accords, right? To reach a broad Middle East peace between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and other Arab states to isolate Iran. And of course, what has happened since the Gaza war is we have seen Iran being weakened both by military attrition against Hamas and also the losses that Hezbollah has suffered in Lebanon. Mm-hmm.
So we are watching once more the rotunda.
Do you think that given that Donald Trump...
Carry on, Simon.
No, I was just going to ask Adrian, Jill, on the issue of Iran. Given that Donald Trump pulled the country out of the Iran nuclear deal that European nations, of course, are trying to restore, do you think he's got credibility sufficiently to try and bring about a new policy and a new set of arrangements, both in terms of that Iran nuclear deal and perhaps more directly with Iran itself?
Simon, that is a great question. So I think Trump will now be able to do so because this is a plan that he will try to claim as his own. So with the JCPOA, right, he refuted the JCPOA because he saw that as Barack Obama's plan. So he will go in fresh this time with Iran.
All right, let's progress this. What do you see as the knock-on effect of the progress, fragile progress in the Middle East on Russia and Ukraine and the war there? Might the incoming Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and he said this, I'm just going to quote him, the reality of it is that the way the war in Ukraine is going to end is with a negotiated settlement. So do we have some kind of momentum?
So this is, I think, what the Trump administration will definitely hope for, that there will be sort of diplomatic momentum, as you call it, to move the peace process forward in Europe. And this will then allow the U.S. to basically focus on what they've always considered its principal theater, which is Asia.
Over to you, Simon.
Well, one last question for Adrian from here, Jill. As we see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris walking into the rotunda of the Capitol to observe this transition of power and Donald Trump's inauguration, Donald Trump, of course, has personal relationships that already exist with Vladimir Putin, with President Xi Jinping, with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. What is the likelihood, do you think, Adrian, that he's going to be able to use those relationships either to break or soften what has been called the axis of resistance and evil?
Again, Simon, that is a terrific question. So Trump, I think, has this unique opportunity, one that has probably not been available to an American president since Richard Nixon, to basically change the strategic relationship between the United States, Russia, and China. So I think here we have both Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin trying to figure out what Trump intends to do, right? Because, you know, to paraphrase Bismarck, in a world of three powers, you want to be one of two. So is Trump prepared to cut a deal with either Xi or Putin, leaving either Russia or China then isolated?
What else should we be looking for in terms of foreign relationships, particularly in the wider, into China, for example?
So For China, of course, right, we in the intro, it was already mentioned that China's vice president is represented at the inauguration.
That's significant.
And we've already seen that vice president has already spoken with both Elon Musk and with JD Vance. So there are already negotiations, I think, going on, following on from President Xi's telephone conversation with Donald Trump on Friday.
All right, we'll get to pick this up in a little while, but now as we watch Christopher DiMaggio, the opera singer, singing for us as we await the entrance of Donald Trump, we will be taking a short break a little later, and here we see more members and VIPs, Amy Klobuchar coming in there, as well as Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House. I'm wondering, as we wait for that moment to come, Adrian, is it important that the U.S. continue to maintain some kind of role, some kind of position as a negotiator in global conflict without leaving the door open for perhaps other countries, Middle East, China, to step in?
Sure. So what the U.S., you know, has to do is to maintain all these diplomatic relations, as you mentioned. Here, the question or the concern is Trump's dislike for multilateral institutions, his, you know, so-called disdain for allies and partners who believe are sort of, you know, dragging America down. So his emphasis is really on bilateral relations.
Absolutely. Okay, we'll get into that a little bit as one more man left to come out, Donald Trump, preparing for the last few steps into the rotunda. Here is Melania Trump preparing to make her entrance, led by the Sergeant of Arms. Now, we're off for a short break. The U.S. presidential inauguration will continue after this.
Single at 36.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Are you a mommy boy?
How much is your salary as a DJ in MediaCorp?
These questions are so much better than what I get on a day-to-day basis.
Joaquin Gomez, popular radio presenter and host on The Assembly. Wednesday on CNA.
Saturday on Japan Hour.
日本のメーカーさんってすごく商品展開をこう早いスピードでいろんなバリエーションでやってらっしゃるので季節に合わせて様々な形のゼリー菓子を製造しています。米でこんなうまくなるんだって本当にびっくりしました。みんなびっくりすると思います。特に海外の方。So
many various styles.
Yeah, very big choice.
Yeah,
Japan Hour, Saturday on CNA. Japan Hour is brought to you by Sumitomo Corporation, Daikin, MUFG, committed to empowering a brighter future, Zip Air, winter fares are now available, and IHI.
My world revolves around my phone.
I'd rather have a phone than have a girlfriend.
My brain's just so trapped into the social media life.
It's hard to break out of a routine that you've been in for years.
Wow, I don't have my phone, huh? Okay, I'm gonna die here.
This affects their decision-making processes and attention.
Why is that Nokia?
You have to keep pressing until you get the outlet.
It's the most useless thing ever.
It's good for you to have these things.
No.
They will have an issue.
Maybe they'll use this as a hammer.
My mother just sent my message, right? She said, I don't understand what you're saying.
We are planning to run cognitive tests before and after the detox.
Will this detox change something?
The CNA Summit 2025, Trade-Offs in Leadership. Presenting partner, Singlife, a better way to financial freedom. CEOs face daunting challenges, making tough calls on trade-offs, while carefully balancing business objectives with stakeholders' expectations. How do they unite the organization behind a cohesive strategy that would distinguish success from those that struggle to adapt? The CNA Summit 2025, coming to you this February. Brought to you by MediaCorp.
Welcome back to the U.S. presidential inauguration. Special coverage on CNA. Live pictures from the Capitol at the Rotunda, where we have just seen the incoming Vice President J.D. Vance coming in. Big smile on his face and for the crowd. Soon, this man will be the second most powerful man in America. The 40-year-old will be the third youngest VP in history when he takes office. Now, the Trump presidency will have significant impact on other countries in Asia as well. We hear from the CNA correspondents in the region on what their capitals expect from the next 4 years.
Seoul will have to navigate uncertainty in ties with Washington during a period of political turmoil, which has left South Korea without an elected leader. Amid rising tensions on the Korean Peninsula, Mr. Trump's attitudes towards North Korea, which has been forging closer ties with Russia, will be a key concern for South Koreans. And the cost of defense could come to the fore, with the Trump administration expected to seek renegotiation on the bill for stationing American military personnel in South Korea.
The alliance between Japan and the U.S. is stronger than ever, according to the outgoing U.S. government. But here in Tokyo, Joe Biden's move to block Nippon Steel's takeover of U.S. Steel due to national security concerns has disappointed Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba and business leaders. Japan is the largest foreign investor in the U.S., and its stance is that the deal will help make the American steel industry great again and save jobs. Will Mr. Trump rethink the deal?
Donald Trump is calling on Taiwan to spend a hefty 10% of its GDP on defense in order to stand up to China. But this push for a stronger military is putting a strain on Taiwan's economy. It's also ramping up tensions across the strait. China has already responded with more aggressive military drills, raising fears of further instability in the Taiwan Strait. Donald Trump's policies are reshaping Taiwan's strategic future, pushing for stronger defense but risking greater cross-strait conflict.
With expectations for an America First policy, a second Trump administration certainly raises concerns across several factors. Topping that list is tariffs, with Mr. Trump having previously floated the idea of a 60% tariff on goods from China and a 20% tariff on everything else imported by the United States. It could have both direct and indirect repercussions for Indonesia, especially in the aftermath of the country's latest move to join BRICS. There have also been tariff threats on any potential de-dollarization efforts by the BRICS bloc, so Jakarta will be watching the developments in the U.S. very closely.
As the United States' oldest ally in the Indo-Pacific, the Philippines is expected to maintain close ties with a Western superpower. The U.S. has access to 9 Philippine military bases, and U.S. soldiers are deployed here on rotation. Far-left activists argue these deals make the country a target for U.S. rivals like China. But under a Trump presidency, this alliance is expected to continue, an alliance that has been described as ironclad across presidents.
Donald Trump and India's Narendra Modi are reportedly good friends, and New Delhi says it's hoping to work constructively with Trump. Both sides are expected to continue to prioritize security and defense ties in the Indo-Pacific with an eye on countering China. But India is bracing for friction on the trade front, with Trump calling New Delhi a big abuser of tariffs and threatening reciprocal taxes. Many hardline Trump supporters are also calling for the H-1B visa to be scrapped. That brings skilled IT workers to the US, and that's led to some anxiety here in New Delhi, with 70% of those visas going to Indians.
Let's go now to live pictures from in the rotunda, where Senator Amy Klobuchar is now giving the call to order. Just moments earlier, we saw the president-to-be walk in, take a seat just behind the rotunda. You can see there, surrounded by family members. The Trump family, no strangers to the front row seats. Loyalty, a big thing in that family. Trump advisors are certainly among his family, the closest people to have his ear.
And Capitol staff and law enforcement who
well, let's bring back our studio guest, Dr. Adrian Ung, who is with me for the next hour. Adrian, I want to talk about China a little bit, because we have seen just moments ago walking in China Hawk, Marco Rubio, to be, if all goes well, U.S. State Secretary. China knows this. Have they started recalibrating for a fresh Trump presidency? They have already started talking even before today.
Yes, so President Xi spoke with President-elect Trump on Friday, and Vice President Zhang is in Washington for the inauguration, and he has spoken both to J.D. Vance and also to Elon Musk. And I think China is sort of prepared to engage with Trump 2.0, but they are also braced for the worst. And China has been doing so for a long time, right? So they've been prepared even before the trade war in 2018. China has, under Xi Jinping, its dual circulation policy. So they are really braced for more strategic competition with the United States.
Understand. And Adrian, I'm just going to come in there because we're going to cut to Simon Marks in Washington, D.C. for some breaking news.
Well, Jill, as we edge towards the moment when power is going to transition from Joe Biden to President Donald Trump, we've got some breaking news in from the White House that in the final minutes of his presidency, Joe Biden has issued preemptive pardons for several of his family members. They include his brothers, James and Frank, his sister, Valerie, along with their spouses. That move comes just a matter of hours after the White House revealed that President Biden was also issuing preemptive pardons for all the members of Congress who sat on the committee that investigated the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill, for some of the police officers who testified before that committee about the excesses carried out by Donald Trump supporters that day in 2021, and also preemptive pardons for General Mark Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff here, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the figure, of course, who led America's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, these preemptive pardons for those people and for family members, absolutely unprecedented. As Donald Trump sits there listening to Amy Klobuchar begin, really, the ceremonial aspects of this swearing in, we don't know whether he is yet aware that President Biden has now extended those preemptive pardons to members of his own family. But an astonishing series of events designed by President Biden to protect some of those people that he clearly feels could have been targeted going forwards by members of Donald Trump's incoming administration for the retribution. That's the word that Donald Trump and many of his supporters have used over the past several months. So astonishing news coming from the White House in the dying, 12 minutes of the Biden presidency that underscores the fact that even though one is watching here a fairly normal tableau, the peaceful transition of power, underneath the waterline, what we're seeing here in Washington, D.C., Jill, is anything but normal.
Yeah, well, we did expect a roller coaster ride. Thanks, Simon. Simon Marks in Washington, just delivering some breaking news. And in brief, in the final minutes of his presidency, Joe Biden has issued preemptive pardons, including those for his sister, brother, and other members of his family. Not sure whether anyone in the rotunda is aware of this right now, but Simon Marks with that breaking news. Adrian, come back to you. We were speaking about Trump and Asia. I want to talk about the role of Elon Musk. Does he have sway when it comes to U.S.-China ties? He's a powerful advocate for Trump. He's also very popular and a very successful business figure in China with close ties to the Chinese leadership. Could he be a liability or a unifier?
So that's a great question, Jill. So Musk has liabilities domestically, I think, right? So if you look at, you know, over the last week, Steve Bannon, who was a former advisor to Donald Trump, has basically declared war on Elon Musk over really the H-1B visas. So we already see Elon Musk as a sort of divisive figure within MAGA world. So, you know, Musk represents the, you know, what Bannon calls the techno-feudalist. And you know, so that sets up, right, sort of the tech oligarchs versus, you know, what Bannon would perceive as the populist, nationalist, America First movement. In foreign policy, we're not so sure yet. We have seen Musk sort of intervene in Europe, where he has made comments about right-wing parties both in Germany and the UK. But he has so far, right, stayed out of US-China relations. So we will see moving forward whether Musk is able to bridge Washington and Beijing, and if there is going to be pushback in D.C., especially among China hawks who, I think, right, sort of are quite determined to push competition with China, right, forward.
Adrian, thank you for that. Right now, we want to talk about the remaking of the immigration policy. That's a major pillar of Trump's America First agenda. And the U.S.-Mexican border, a potential flashpoint. Let's cross there now to Eagle Pass in Texas. Tony Waterman joins us. Tony, Trump's day one promises for the Mexican border what he calls the largest deportation operation yet. Remind us what his plans are and what's happening at the border.
Well, we're expecting that the incoming president will almost immediately declare a national emergency along the border. This would free up funds and resources for him to carry out these deportation plans, including possibly the mobilization of military assets, National Guards troops that could help in the construction of new border wall or in the construction of detention centers, and also to help keep order during what we are expecting to be nationwide raids. Those raids expected to happen starting in the early hours of Tuesday morning. And phase one is really going to focus on these so-called sanctuary cities, these democratic strongholds that have been shielding migrants by limiting their cooperation with federal immigration officials. So places like Los Angeles, Miami, Denver, Chicago, even here in Texas and San Antonio. They are, officials say that they're really going to be going after gang members and dangerous individuals, criminals, although they say that if anyone is found to be in the United States illegally, that they will be subject to deportation. So we could see the storming of immigrant communities, churches, construction sites, really anywhere that migrants are known to live and work. And this has, of course, migrants very fearful at this point. You talk about what's happening here at the border. I can say that a year ago, I was in this same exact spot. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people that were coming over by the hour. At one point, more than 4,000 migrants apprehended every single day right here. And I can tell you that it is an absolute trickle of people that are now coming over. And in fact, the arrest numbers, the apprehensions that Border Patrol has been doing across the southern border is down 60%. And that is because of Biden administration policies. Mexican officials stopping these caravans coming in. And the apprehension numbers are now actually lower than they were when Trump left office. Other things related to migration that we're expecting from him this time around is a potential ending of birthright citizenship, something that has been a principle of the United States since 1868. Also stopping refugee relocation programs, really a lot of things intended to keep migrants out and the ones that are seeking asylum to keep them in Mexico while they're going through that process.
All right, that was Tony Waterman live from the U.S.-Mexico border at Eagle Pass, Texas. That is something, Adrian, if you could bring you back in, that Trump has said that he will go forward and go hard on. But when it comes to Asia, you have said, be careful not to exaggerate Trump and the differences between Trump's approach to Asia. And in fact, there are more continuity areas of continuity than differences in his Asia strategy. True?
I think so. Right. So what we'll see, though, is there will, I think, almost be two U.S. foreign policies. There will be the official U.S. foreign policy, which will see a great deal of continuity. And we have seen that continuity, not just between Trump and Biden, but even from the Obama administration to Trump. And so and so on and so forth. But right, Trump being Trump will also put his own personal stamp on foreign policy. So as we saw in the first Trump administration. So I think we will have an official Trump, an official U.S. foreign policy, and sort of Trump doing his own thing, right? Sort of antagonizing allies, possibly, you know, putting out sort of social media, making foreign policy by social media, but he will ultimately be the decider of foreign policy. Mm. And this also will be quite challenging, I think, because right, there are going to be competing priorities. He will want to purge the bureaucracy. And again, I think, you know, we will see moves to executive orders very soon on that. But he will also want his foreign policy to be executed. And we'll see how challenging that is, right, without the professional bureaucracy in place.
Simon, to you.
As President Donald J. Trump takes the oath of office once again, we come to say thank you, O Lord our God.
Yep. Well, until we reestablish contact with Simon, maybe I ask Adrian of you, if Asia's new reality is, as you said, for them to seize their own agency, rely less on the U.S., there will be those that who excel and those that will struggle with this changing dynamics. Talk to us about that vis-a-vis trade and defense.
So here we will see allies, U.S. allies working much closer with one another, right? So the Biden administration set up what it called its lattice work framework of alliances, which
was spoke and hub.
But spoke and hub really depended on the U.S. As the central hub, right? And with that central hub, there is a single point of failure. So by moving from hub and spokes to lattice work, right, the Biden administration really wanted the allies, the spokes, to cooperate more among themselves. And even then, it was not really a sort of Biden innovation. We can actually trace that back to the first Trump administration that wanted greater cooperation, greater participation by the allies. And I think we will see that. And we will also see the continuation of minilaterals.
Yeah.
So during his confirmation hearings, Marco Rubio said, right, he is supportive both of AUKUS, and we will see, I think, in tomorrow, D.C. time, a convening of the Quad Foreign Ministers meeting. So Right. Minilateralism, I think, will be alive and well in the Trump administration.
But it doesn't preclude that they still have to form stronger links among themselves.
Yes.
You know, Australia, Japan, Philippines, they all have defense links with the U.S. And with less engagement or selective engagement by the U.S., they will have to look to each other to improve their defense relations.
Yes. Right. And also what this will do with, I think, other countries is, again, force other countries to rethink their hedging strategies.
Yeah.
So hedging, you know, if we think about it, has two dimensions. The first dimension is an internal dimension, whether the countries themselves want to hedge between, right, the great powers rather than bandwagon with one against the other. Right. So what we'll probably see in the second Trump administration is greater pressure for countries to choose sides.
I'm going to just jump in here because right now we're watching live pictures of J.D. Vance taking his oath with his wife, Usha, next to him.
I solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith.
That I will bear true faith.
And allegiance to the same.
And allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation.
Without any mental reservation.
Or purpose of evasion.
Or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office.
The duties of the office.
On which I am about to enter.
On which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. Vice President.
To administer the presidential oath of office.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God. Congratulations, Mr. President.
it is my honor and pleasure to introduce to you the 45th and the 47th President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump.
Thank you very much, everybody. Well, thank you very, very much. Vice President Vance, Speaker Johnson, Senator Thune, Chief Justice Roberts, Justices of the United States Supreme Court, President Clinton, President Bush, President Obama, President Biden, Vice President Harris, and my fellow citizens. The golden age of America begins right now. From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world. We will be the envy of every nation, and we will not allow ourselves to be taken advantage of any longer. During every single day of the Trump administration, I will very simply put America first. Our sovereignty will be reclaimed. Our safety will be restored. The scales of justice will be rebalanced. The vicious, violent, and unfair weaponization of the Justice Department and our government will end. And our top priority will be to create a nation that is proud, prosperous, and free. America will soon be greater, stronger, and far more exceptional than ever before. I return to the presidency confident and optimistic that we are at the start of a thrilling new era of national success. A tide of change is sweeping the country, sunlight is pouring over the entire world. And America has the chance to seize this opportunity like never before. But first, we must be honest about the challenges we face. While they are plentiful, they will be annihilated by this great momentum that the world is now witnessing in the United States of America. As we gather today, our government confronts a crisis of trust. For many years, a radical and corrupt establishment has extracted power and wealth from our citizens while the pillars of our society lay broken and seemingly in complete disrepair. We now have a government that cannot manage even a simple crisis at home, while at the same time stumbling into a continuing catalog of catastrophic events abroad. It fails to protect our magnificent, law-abiding American citizens, but provide sanctuary and protection for dangerous criminals, many from prisons and mental institutions that have illegally entered our country from all over the world. We have a government that has given unlimited funding to the defense of foreign borders, but refuses to defend American borders or, more importantly, its own people. Our country can no longer deliver services in times of emergency, as recently shown by the wonderful people of North Carolina, been treated so badly. And other states who are still suffering from a hurricane that took place many months ago. Or more recently, Los Angeles, where we are watching fires still tragically burn. From weeks ago, without even a token of defense, They're raging through the houses and communities, even affecting some of the wealthiest and most powerful individuals in our country, some of whom are sitting here right now. They don't have a home any longer. That's interesting. But we can't let this happen. Everyone is unable to do anything about it. That's going to change. We have a public health system that does not deliver in times of disaster, yet more money is spent on it than any country anywhere in the world. And we have an education system that teaches our children to be ashamed of themselves in many cases, to hate our country despite the love that we try so desperately to provide to them. All of this will change starting today, and it will change very quickly. My recent election is a mandate to completely and totally reverse a horrible betrayal and all of these many betrayals that have taken place, and to give the people back their faith, their wealth, their democracy, and indeed their freedom. From this moment on, America's decline is over. Our liberties and our nation's glorious destiny will no longer be denied, and we will immediately restore the integrity, competency, and loyalty of America's government. Over the past 8 years, I have been tested and challenged more than any president in our 250-year history, and I've learned a lot along the way. The journey to reclaim our republic has not been an easy one, that I can tell you. Those who wish to stop our cause have tried to take my freedom and indeed to take my life. Just a few months ago, in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear. But I felt then, and believe even more so now, that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again. That is why each day under our administration of American patriots, we will be working to meet every crisis with dignity and power and strength. We will move with purpose and speed to bring back hope, prosperity, safety, and peace for citizens of every race, religion, color, and creed. For American citizens, January 20th, 2025 is Liberation Day. It is my hope that our recent presidential election will be remembered as the greatest and most consequential election in the history of our country. As our victory showed, the entire nation is rapidly unifying behind our agenda with dramatic increases in support from virtually every element of our society, young and old, men and women, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, urban, suburban, rural, and very importantly, we had a powerful win in all seven swing states, and the popular vote we won by millions of people. To the Black and Hispanic communities, I want to thank you for the tremendous outpouring of love and trust that you have shown me with your vote. We set records, and I will not forget it. I've heard your voices in the campaign, and I look forward to working with you in the years to come. Today is Martin Luther King Day, and in his honor, this will be a great honor, but in his honor, we will strive together to make his dream a reality. We will make his dream come true. National unity is now returning to America, and confidence and pride is soaring like never before. In everything we do, my administration will be inspired by a strong pursuit of excellence and unrelenting success. We will not forget our country. We will not forget our Constitution. And we will not forget our God. Can't do that. Today, I will sign a series of historic executive orders. With these actions, we will begin the complete restoration of America and the revolution of common sense. It's all about common sense. First, I will declare a national emergency at our southern border. Illegal entry will immediately be halted, and we will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came. We will reinstate my Remain in Mexico policy. I will end the practice of catch and release. And I will send troops to the southern border to repel the disastrous invasion of our country. Under the orders I signed today, we will also be designating the cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. Invoking the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, I will direct our government to use the full and immense power of federal and state law enforcement to eliminate the presence of all foreign gangs and criminal networks, bringing devastating crime to U.S. soil, including our cities and inner cities. As Commander-in-Chief, I have no higher responsibility than to defend our country from threats and invasions, and that is exactly what I am going to do. We will do it at a level that nobody's ever seen before. Next, I will direct all members of my cabinet to marshal the vast powers at their disposal to defeat what was record inflation and rapidly bring down costs and prices. The inflation crisis was caused by massive overspending and escalating energy prices, and that is why today I will also declare a national energy emergency. We will drill, baby, drill. America will be a manufacturing nation once again, and we have something that no other manufacturing nation will ever have, the largest amount of oil and gas of any country on earth, and we are going to use it. Let me use it. We will bring prices down, fill our strategic reserves up again, right to the top, and export American energy all over the world. We will be a rich nation again, and it is that liquid gold under our feet that will help to do it. With my actions today, we will end the Green New Deal, and we will revoke the electric vehicle mandate, saving our auto industry and keeping my sacred pledge to our great American auto workers. In other words, you'll be able to buy the car of your choice. We will build automobiles in America again at a rate that nobody could have dreamt possible just a few years ago. And thank you to the auto workers of our nation for your inspiring vote of confidence. We did tremendously with their vote. I will immediately begin the overhaul of our trade system to protect American workers and families. Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. For this purpose, we are establishing the External Revenue Service to collect all tariffs, duties, and revenues. It will be massive amounts of money pouring into our treasury, coming from foreign sources. The American dream will soon be back and thriving like never before to restore competence and effectiveness to our federal government. My administration will establish the brand new Department of Government Efficiency. After years and years of illegal and unconstitutional federal efforts to restrict free expression, I will also sign an executive order to immediately stop all government censorship and bring back free speech to America. Never again will the immense power of the state be weaponized to persecute political opponents, something I know something about. We will not allow that to happen. It will not happen again. Under my leadership, we will restore fair, equal, and impartial justice under the constitutional rule of law. And we are going to bring law and order back to our cities. This week, I will also end the government policy of trying to socially engineer race and gender into every aspect of public and private life. We will forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based. As of today, it will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. This week, I will reinstate any service members who were unjustly expelled from our military for objecting to the COVID vaccine mandate with full back pay. And I will sign an order to stop our warriors from being subjected to radical political theories and social experiments while on duty. It's going to end immediately. Our armed forces will be freed to focus on their sole mission, defeating America's enemies. Like in 2017, we will again build the strongest military the world has ever seen. We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into. My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and unifier. That's what I want to be, a peacemaker and a unifier. I'm pleased to say that as of yesterday, one day before I assumed office, the hostages in the Middle East are coming back home to their families. America will reclaim its rightful place as the greatest, most powerful, most respected nation on earth, inspiring the awe and admiration of the entire world. A short time from now, we are going to be changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, and we will restore the name of a great president, William McKinley, to Mount McKinley, where it should be and where it belongs. President McKinley made our country very rich through tariffs and through talent. He was a natural businessman and gave Teddy Roosevelt the money for many of the great things he did, including the Panama Canal, which has foolishly been given to the country of Panama after the United States. The United States, I mean, think of this, spent more money than ever spent on a project before and lost 38,000 lives in the building of the Panama Canal. We have been treated very badly from this foolish gift that should have never been made, and Panama's promise to us has been broken. The purpose of our deal and the spirit of our treaty has been totally violated. American ships are being severely overcharged and not treated fairly in any way, shape, or form. And that includes the United States Navy. And above all, China is operating the Panama Canal. And we didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama. And we're taking it back. Above all, my message to Americans today is that it is time for us to once again act with courage, vigor, and the vitality of history's greatest civilization. So as we liberate our nation, we will lead it to new heights of victory and success. We will not be deterred. Together, we will end the chronic disease epidemic and keep our children safe, healthy, and disease-free. The United States will once again consider itself a growing nation, one that increases our wealth, expands our territory, builds our cities, raises our expectations, and carries our flag into new and beautiful horizons. and we will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars. Ambition is the lifeblood of a great nation. And right now, our nation is more ambitious than any other. There's no nation like our nation. Americans are explorers, builders, innovators, entrepreneurs, and pioneers. The spirit of the frontier is written into our hearts. The call of the next great adventure resounds from within our souls. Our American ancestors turned a small group of colonies on the edge of a vast continent into a mighty republic of the most extraordinary citizens on Earth. No one comes close. Americans pushed thousands of miles through a rugged land of untamed wilderness. They crossed deserts, scaled mountains, braved untold dangers, won the Wild West, ended slavery, rescued millions from tyranny, lifted billions from poverty, harnessed electricity, split the atom, launched mankind into the heavens, and put the universe of human knowledge into the palm of the human hand. If we work together, there is nothing we cannot do and no dream we cannot achieve. Many people thought it was impossible for me to stage such a historic political comeback. But as you see today, here I am, the American people have spoken. I stand before you now as proof that you should never believe that something is impossible to do. In America, the impossible is what we do best. From New York to Los Angeles, from Philadelphia to Phoenix, from Chicago to Miami, from Houston to right here in Washington, D.C., our country was forged and built by the generations of patriots who gave everything they had for our rights and for our freedom. They were farmers and soldiers, cowboys and factory workers, steel workers and coal miners, police officers and pioneers who pushed onward, marched forward, and let no obstacle defeat their spirit or their pride. Together they laid down the railroads, raised up the skyscrapers, built great highways, won two world wars, defeated fascism and communism, and triumphed over every single challenge that they faced. After all we have been through together, we stand on the verge of the four greatest years in American history. With your help, we will restore America's promise, and we will rebuild the nation that we love, and we love it so much. We are one people, one family, and one glorious nation under God. So to every parent who dreams for their child, and every child who dreams for their future, I am with you, I will fight for you, and I will win for you. We are going to win like never before. Thank you. In recent years, our nation has suffered greatly, but we are going to bring it back and make it great again, greater than ever before. We will be a nation like no other, full of compassion, courage, and exceptionalism. Our power will stop all wars and bring a new spirit of unity to a world that has been angry, violent, and totally unpredictable. America will be respected again and admired again. including by people of religion, faith, and goodwill, we will be prosperous, we will be proud, we will be strong, and we will win like never before. We will not be conquered, we will not be intimidated, we will not be broken, and we will not fail. From this day on, the United States of America will be a free, sovereign, and independent nation. We will stand bravely, we will live proudly, we will dream boldly, and nothing will stand in our way because we are Americans. The future is ours, and our golden age has just begun. Thank you. God bless America. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
To standing cheers there, you've just witnessed another monumental step in the continuation of the transfer of power. In his inauguration speech, Donald Trump says the golden age of America begins right now. This day will be known as Liberation Day. Now let's bring in Simon Mark, standing by for us in Washington, D.C. Simon, so much to pick up from there. The tone, the demeanor, very measured, very seasoned and presidential.
Well, look, Jill, I mean, he didn't use the phrase American carnage, which, of course, was the phrase that he used back in January of 2017. So this speech was not quite as dark and funereal as that address. But make no mistake, he was absolutely flaying not just Joe Biden and members of his administration, but all previous modern American presidential administrations in declaring this not only Inauguration Day, but Liberation Day for the United States. He portrayed an American government that, in his telling, can no longer meet the basic needs of America's citizens, can no longer even provide adequate response to natural disasters like the hurricane that struck North Carolina a few months ago and the wildfires that have ravaged Los Angeles over the last several days. This is a man who was promising exactly what he delivered on the campaign trail, a complete shift in governing behavior here in the United States domestically and towards its allies. He has plans, he said, to declare an emergency at the country's southern border, just one of the steps that he's going to be taking as he kickstarts through a series of executive orders that he'll be signing here later today, the beginning of the mass deportation, he said in that speech, of millions of immigrants from the United States. He says he's going to set up an external revenue service to collect all of the tariffs that he plans to impose on goods heading into the country. He is completely overturning the U.S. government's policy on both gender and also on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusivity, shredding all of those. And he went further than he's gone before in talking about the Panama Canal, saying, "We are taking it back." He had not previously spoken as declaratively about his plans to go after the Panama Canal. So I think, I mean, it would be fascinating to know how on earth this has gone down with members of the Biden administration and with the president's predecessors, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. But this was absolutely a revolutionary and radical speech by now President Donald Trump, the man who very soon will have the nuclear suitcase at his side, once again, America's commander-in-chief. And it was also interesting that towards the end of the speech, Jill, he actually sort of turned something that President Biden has often said to his own advantage. He's often said that there's nothing, President Biden has said, there's nothing Americans can't do if they don't unite and come together. Donald Trump said there's nothing Americans can do if they don't unite and come together, and further insisted that he was proof of the possibilities that exist in the United States by dint of his own personal political recovery, something that seemed utterly unimaginable just a couple of years ago. So it was, I think, a quite extraordinary address that the president has just wrapped up there, and it will, I think, be raising eyebrows not just here in Washington, D.C., among the president's critics, but it will be thrilling. The president's supporters, who sent him here to make good on the policy pledges that he offered them on the campaign trail, and he indicated in this speech, and we'll see what happens in the hours ahead with these executive orders, that he is absolutely focused like a laser on bringing about massive, substantial change to the United States.
Almighty God.
Simon, thank you very much. Standing out there in the call for us in front of that flag raised full in the background, Simon Marks, reporting live from Washington. Now, I'd like to introduce our next studio guest, Steve Okun. He is founder and CEO of APEC Advisors. Steve, you've been listening to this speech for the past half hour. Take what Simon has called a revolutionary speech. Translate that into a priority list for Trump over the next 100 days. What does that look like?
Well, Donald Trump said that this was the most consequential election in the history of the United States. Well, if he does half of the things that he said he was going to do in his address, he could very well be correct that this is one of the most consequential elections. Interestingly, he talked about emergency powers, and when a president invokes his emergency powers, it gives him greater authority than he would have otherwise in our system of checks and balances. He talked about an emergency at the southern border. He talked about a national energy emergency. What is he going to do with these emergency powers? Are we going to see the United States military involved in operations in our cities, trying to deport the millions of people that Donald Trump said he wants deported? So there is a great deal to unpack in this speech from a substantive perspective.
What does it mean on the ground? Now, there were clearly some similarities with his 2017 speech, some differences. Point those out for us.
Well, I mean, he didn't use the phrase, you know, American carnage. He had some of the typical, you know, the typical rhetoric you would see in a State of the Union, talking about bringing in the golden age of America, saying, you know, we're going to have four of the greatest years in American history, talking about a revolution of common sense. You know, all of those things you could see in some other speeches. But there was a lot you wouldn't see in other inaugural addresses. There was an airing of the grievances in this speech about the weaponization of the Justice Department, about having more than two genders, about looking at the harm that has been caused from a foreign policy perspective, from a lack of preparedness for natural disasters, which isn't the case. But what Donald Trump made clear is that he said he has a mandate with this election. Now, if you look at this from an electoral perspective, he doesn't have a mandate. He didn't even get 50% of the popular vote. His vote total was of a 1.5% margin, very narrow from a historical perspective in the United States. But he doesn't talk that way. He's not going to govern that way. And we're going to see the most powerful president we've had since Roosevelt, and he had all those wartime authorities in World War II. And that's what we have to get ready for, and that's what we saw in this speech.
Now, the speech mostly directed towards a domestic audience. But because you're an expert in Asia, did he build any political capital at all with Asia? Maybe nothing specific, but we can infer from what he said.
Well, one of the most interesting things he said was that he was going to rename Mount Denali, which is in Alaska, back to Mount McKinley.
Right.
And so President McKinley in the 1900s and late 1800s was one of his heroes, because McKinley did all of those tariffs. And so we can expect to see a lot of tariffs coming at Asia if his fondness for McKinley goes beyond renaming the mountain back for him. And so when he talked about creating this new, you know, I think this new power to collect tariffs. He's going to create a new agency to do that. He doesn't need to create a new agency to do that. Customs does that today. So focusing on tariffs, even though this speech wasn't directly about tariffs, that's something that people all over the world, certainly in Asia, need to be worried about. How much tariffs is Donald Trump going to be implementing, if not on day one, within the first 100 days or so?
Yeah, I mean, the very fact that he's given it a name shows that he is serious about this. Now, I want to ask you about Trump's plans moving forward. He's got a heavy agenda of signing 100 to 200 executive orders in just a few minutes there. I wonder, is there a reliance too much on executive orders? How can anyone trust a country that every 4 years one president undoes what another president does? You know, and he's given us a whole list of things there. Very little longevity in action. So will this change now that he controls both chambers of Congress?
Well, he certainly has fewer guardrails on his power because he has the entire Congress with him. But the majorities in the Congress are extraordinarily narrow. In the House, he can only lose 2 votes right now. In the Senate, he can only lose 3 votes out of it with the 53 senators, a fourth, and he loses. And so he's going to have to really thread the needle from a legislative perspective. I mean, I certainly think that the Republicans will find some way to enact his tax cuts, keep the 2017 tax cuts alive. But when it comes to immigration, that is going to be very difficult to get Congress. When it comes to entitlement reform, that's going to be difficult for Congress to do. So Donald Trump is going to do what Joe Biden did, which is what Donald Trump did in the first term, what Barack Obama does. You rely on executive orders. As Barack Obama said, I've got a pen and I'm going to use it. Donald Trump is going to use his pen a couple hundred times, and it's going to focus where the president has power that the Congress has given him, and that is going to be on control of the executive branch. He's going to go after foreign and career civil service officers through his authority there. He's going to use it on immigration. Harder to undo those things, especially when you fire hundreds, if not thousands of people. When you deport millions of people, the next president doesn't matter. You just can't sign it back in. They're gone. Mm-hmm. And so he does have a lot of authority through those executive orders. Not as much as legislation, but he has authority and he's going to use it.
Understood. And hold that thought for a little second. We want to talk about the Singapore Prime Minister, Lawrence Wong. Now, he is saying he's confident the United States will continue to exercise its global role under President Donald Trump's leadership. In a letter to Mr. Trump, he congratulated the U.S. president following his inauguration. He says both countries enjoy a deep partnership underpinned by close defense and economic ties, such as their free trade agreement. Now, he adds that both sides can work together to advance many shared interests and that the U.S. can depend on Singapore as a trusted friend and partner. Now, President Tharman Shanmugaratnam also extending his best wishes to Mr. Trump. In his letter, he says Singapore stands ready to build upon the foundation of their bilateral ties. He adds both sides can look to further enhance existing ties as well as explore new areas of collaboration. He adds, Mr. Trump's presidency will be crucial in addressing the challenges and opportunities facing the U.S. as well as the world. Prime Minister Wong and President Tharman also expressed their hopes for Mr. Trump to visit Singapore soon. Steve, bring you back into the conversation. We've been asking our viewers for their questions, and we've got a couple for you here. One we've heard many times before, why is the U.S. allowing a convicted felon to become president? And the second, will Trump, Mr. Trump, President Trump, still go to prison for his crimes now that he is president?
Okay. The second answer, question's easy. No. Get rid of that. No, he's not. First one, look, our Constitution does not put many limits on who can be president. And there is no limit in our Constitution saying a convicted felon cannot be president. It leaves it to the voters to decide. And in this election, when voters very well knew who Donald Trump was, he's probably the candidate voters knew the most about in the history of the United States running for a third time. They voted for him.
Yes.
They have him. And that's why he is the president. And so anybody who gets the most votes, if you meet the very bare minimum on constitutional requirements, birth, you know, citizen born in the U.S. and of a certain age, and he meets it. Therefore, he's president.
The thing is, he still has, eight civil cases following. He is now the sitting president. Do you think the American people have the appetite to go through another long, drawn-out legal battle?
No, they don't. And also, it is not necessarily in the Constitution, and it's not even necessarily a law. But when you are president, you do not get prosecuted for those types of actions. So it doesn't mean he can't get prosecuted again 4 years from now, but he is not going to be facing those civil cases or criminal cases while he is in the White House.
All right. Another question from Facebook. This viewer asks, how did Mr. Trump select his team? Any discernible strategies or patterns that you can see?
There seem to be two types of people he chose for his cabinet. In the one area where he really wants control, where we're talking about of the Justice Department, of the military, of the intelligence community, he took in true America First people who are loyal to him. Yeah. That is who he selected. He selected, you know, Pete Hegseth for defense, and Pam Biondi for justice, and Kash Patel for the FBI. Those are where we've got national security and prosecutorial authority. Mm. He wanted people loyal to him.
No surprise.
Well, it is a bit of a surprise because they wouldn't get confirmed almost by any other Senate. Now, when it came to more of the policymaking side, and Marco Rubio would be a perfect example of this, he took America First people. Marco Rubio would be confirmed by any Senate, Democratic or Republican. I mean, that is who the president chose. He's well credentialed. He's got years in the Senate. That is a totally normal pick, and he took somebody who believes in that America First agenda. So if you take out the national security and prosecutorial agencies, they get one set of nominees, and the rest are more America First.
Yeah, they're still all, as you said, nominees, right? So are there any picks that you can see that won't make it?
Well, we certainly saw one who didn't make it was Matt Gaetz for Attorney General. And he was even a step too far for the Republicans in the Senate with all of the criminal activity and allegations against him. You certainly want to see if this Republican Senate is going to confirm somebody like Tulsi Gabbard, who has a lot of issues in terms of her approach to national security. Mm. And if she gets confirmed by this Republican Senate, it shows there's going to be little or no resistance from the Republican Senate to almost anything that Donald Trump wants to get done. That's the test case to watch right now.
Last question. Are you getting signals from the Democrats? What are they sending out? Will they come alongside Trump in a spirit of cooperation? And they're going to have to figure out how to deal with MAGA. MAGA's not going to go away, even after Trump.
Well, the way the Democrats look at this a bit is that, look, Donald Trump has 2 years because he and the Democrats say, in a way, he is going to overstep. When you start deporting millions and millions of people, that's not necessarily what everybody signed up for. When you start putting all of these tariffs on, that is also going to cause inflation. So he has two inflationary policies that he really wants to put forward, on tariffs and on deportations. And the Democrats say, let him do that. Let the American people see what they voted for so that when we get the midterm elections 2 years from now, the Democrats can get the House back. Probably not the Senate, but maybe. But certainly the House is where they have the strongest chance. So the Democrats, in a way, are, let the Republicans, they bought it, you know, they own it. Let them deal with it. And we will make clear, as they try and put people like Pete Hegseth into a position of Secretary of Defense, for which most people historically would say he's not qualified because he's never run anything like the Defense Department, no experience at all. Let him have somebody like that there and see what happens. And so I think that's what the Democrats are going to do a bit. Step back, let him do what he's going to do, and then when the consequences are have to be paid for, we'll run on that in
we
2 years.
We will see. Two words. Buckle up.
Yeah, buckle right. up.
All right. Very many thanks to Steve Okun. Joining me in the studio, he is the founder and CEO of APEC Advisors. Thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a new day, a new era, and that is our special coverage for Donald Trump's inauguration. Don't forget to check out more on this story and everything else at CNA.Asia, CNA 938 Radio, Facebook, and also check us out on YouTube. Leave you now with a look at the memorable moments from the inauguration ceremony.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend. The Constitution of the United States. So help me God. Congratulations, Mr. President.
It is my honor and pleasure to introduce to you the 45th and the 47th President of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump.
From this moment on, America's decline is over. Nothing will stand in our way because we are Americans. The future is ours. And our golden age has just begun.
Thank you very much.
Great.